I've got a question for Saul. Our terms of trade and inflation have benefited from the cheap Chinese imports we've been having over several years. Do you think that this might sort of turn around as the labour supply in China might become constrained and we might actually no longer enjoy this in the future?
Well, that's obviously a possibility, although I would note, A, that labour costs have been rising, particularly in southern China, and that provincial governments have actually been mandating increases in minimum wages, but that the prices of goods exported from China, at least to the United States, where they publish distinct indices of this, continue to show declines averaging between 1% and 2% per annum, presumably because Chinese companies have been able to achieve productivity growth that's rapid enough to absorb not only increases in labour costs but also very substantial increases in commodity prices, from which, of course, Australia has been one of the prime beneficiaries. And given the resources that the Chinese are putting into education and research and development and to infrastructure, my working assumption would be that the Chinese, at least for another decade or so, will continue to generate the kind of productivity growth gains that will allow them to absorb increases in labour costs. There are still, remember, something like 800 million people living in China outside of the major cities. In China's population is about 1.2 billion, something like that. So two-thirds of them are still essentially working in subsistence agriculture or in, you know, things around that. And the potential for labour to migrate to industrial activities to the major cities is still fairly substantial. And so I wouldn't suggest that the pattern of growth that China has seen is anywhere near exhaustion. Rather, I think the bigger risk to China's capacity to supply the world with a growing range of relatively cheap goods is the possibility of policies in Western countries that seek to countermand that. Now, China does have a problem in the sense that, as yesterday's trade surplus numbers, surplus of $28 billion for February, show, is that their exports are still growing at over 30% per annum in a world in which total exports are growing by about 13% per annum. And that's probably becoming less politically sustainable now that China's exports are 9% of the world total rather than 2% as they were 15 years ago. That's why I said before that there is a growing risk of a protectionist backlash in the United States towards that. And while, well, the biggest casualties of that, of course, would be American consumers. I mean, they don't see it that way because protectionism is always presented by its exponents as something nice and cuddly. You know, it's sort of protecting jobs, even though what it's really doing is ripping off consumers in order to keep inefficient industries in operation. But it would also obviously mean it would, in effect, reduce some of the disciplines on the price-setting behaviour of American firms and workers, resulting in higher inflation, higher interest rates than would otherwise be the case, and thus probably a shorter-lived economic expansion, as well as doing damage, as it would be intended to do, to the Chinese economy and hence ultimately for China's demand for our minerals. So Australia has a lot at stake in, not that we don't have a big voice in Washington on these sort of things, but we have a lot at stake in whatever capacity there is in Washington and elsewhere in the United States to resist this kind of protectionist sentiment that really is growing in the US to an extent that we don't understand here.
Robert Rockefeller, Treasurer, I noticed a couple of comments you made, and I must agree with a few of them. One in particular is I don't think the ABS in particular actually captures overall growth in the state and actually demand, et cetera. And I think while Saul might believe 2.75% is a bit optimistic, I actually think the growth rates have been much higher than what is captured. And I think the economy will remain strong going into the future. I think one of the disturbing aspects is obviously the low productivity we do have in the state. And again, that's where Saul Eastlake mentions we possibly have the most expensive labour force in the in Australia, not the the cheapest. And I think some of the things you're doing in terms of water and sewerage is just fantastic, and you should be congratulated on taking that issue up. Microeconomic reform is very important, and CETA is a leader in this in Australia. As you may or may not know, Treasurer, they've come up with a major report on the water and sewage industry over the last 10 years. In particular, I draw your attention to one of the chapters in case studies on the IPART review in New South Wales. And my two questions I have in relation to water and sewage is, what is your time frame in relation to this microeconomic reform? And secondly, how can CETA and the business community support you in encouraging the state to go forward in relation to try and increase productivity and investment in this infrastructure?
Basically, the time frame for my part, as you know, that we have a project team working with local government to try and find out the actual nature and extent of the issue in terms of our infrastructure and water and sewage. I would expect to get some report back from them by March. I would be hesitant to put a definite time frame, but we do have to keep a consideration of the federal government as a player in this. Malcolm Turnbull has taken an interest in what we're doing and how we're reviewing what is occurring in water and sewage, and has said to us that he will wait for our application or submission to him in terms of the National Water Initiative, and in the latest round concerning the Murray-Darling Basin, where there's obviously a lot of money being allocated to there, and that Tasmania can participate in some of that funding. I think that we move with a fair bit of speed on this issue. We have a window in our history to be able to grab hold of this opportunity, and I don't want to squander it. There will be those who will be opposed to any change. I think there is an acceptance that the status quo cannot be sustained, but the nature and extent of the change is I haven't settled on any particular model. Therefore, I can't indicate to you how you can help other than in terms of acknowledging the problem and that we have a lot of unmet need in terms of developing our infrastructure in this state. I can't overstate the relative position of Tasmania to the rest of Australia. We just have to grab hold of this. If we don't, we're just going to squander what I consider a major competitive advantage in terms of not only our economic growth, but in terms of having sustainable communities. To have 23 water supply areas on permanent boil water alert is damaging our brand. Now, there are people in those communities who say, no, we're quite happy, thanks. But tourists are going into those areas and coming out again with their head, shaking their head, saying, what's going on? You've got 12% of the water. Why is it in a state which is can be potentially damaging to public health? So I just say to you, Robert, in terms of the timing, it's a matter of just trying to get all the planets in a row here, and that one of those planets is Malcolm Turnbull, and that I don't want to miss that opportunity, and, you know, for the state's future, that I think that we need to act with some degree of speed.
Peter Armstrong from Connect Financial. The Treasurer alluded to the importance of trade between Tasmania and China and how we don't measure the full extent. This is a question to Saul. Would you like to comment on the exchange rate system that China is applying and the impact on Tasmania and Australia of that system?
Well, I'll do my best. The Chinese had a fixed exchange rate between 1994 and July 2005. And at the time, particularly during the second half of the 1990s, China's maintenance of a fixed exchange rate was held up by the rest of the world as a major contribution to stabilising conditions in this time zone, when almost every other Asian country saw its currency drop substantially out of bed as part of the financial crisis. The Chinese drew from that experience the lesson that too swiftly opening up their financial system, including the exchange rate mechanism, to the free flow of what are very substantial amounts of capital could potentially inflict major damage on the financial system and the economy, because that's what happened in almost every other Asian country, including fairly developed ones such as Korea, as well as much poorer ones such as the Philippines and Indonesia. And so since July last year, they have followed a path which says, we know that ultimately we need much greater flexibility in the exchange rate than where we're starting from. We also know that after 50 or more years of very detailed government control of almost everything that's done by private sector enterprises in other parts of the world, that there is very limited understanding in China of what exchange rate actually entails, and very limited capacity in the financial system and in the corporate sector to manage the risks associated with a freely floating exchange rate. So that what they've been doing is gradually allowing more movement in the exchange rate within a fairly limited band, and introducing new concepts, new trading techniques, new tools for becoming aware, heightening awareness of and managing the concept of exchange rate risk. And because they run a large surplus and are thus not dependent on foreign capital, they have the capacity to determine for themselves the rate at which they open up. If they were running a deficit and thus depend on capital from the rest of the world, then they would be in a somewhat different position. Because they also have aspirations to being one of the world's top nations, they are much less likely to succumb to American pressure to appreciate their currency more rapidly, for reasons that have got nothing to do with China's interests but are a sop to protectionists within the United States. I mean, the truth is that America is running a large budget, a large current account deficit, because it's saving a lot less than it invests. And if the Chinese were significantly to appreciate the yuan, that would make no difference to the pattern of saving or investment in China. All it might make a difference to is who the US runs a deficit with, rather than the size of its overall deficit. And so in that sense, the Americans would be much better off focusing on their own house. I mean, it is in China's interests to have a more flexible exchange rate regime, but not right now, and the more that America pushes them to change the exchange rate regime in order to support America's interests as they see them, the less likely it is that China will move sort of quickly or expeditiously. So these things will evolve. I don't think that there are profound implications for Tasmania or for Australia arising from this, other than that, to the extent that China does gain some kind of advantage from an allegedly undervalued exchange rate. And I'm not saying that I agree with that, but it's obviously a view that the American administration holds to. To the extent that China is gaining an advantage from that, clearly it is buying more stuff from us because it's selling more stuff that it makes with stuff that it buys from us. And it's therefore to our advantage that, you know, whatever is in China's economic interests is probably in our economic interest also. It may not be in our strategic and military interests, but that's a kind of set of choices that Australia's going to have to think about in a way that we never had to think about in the context of our relationships with Japan. And it's part of the reason why you don't see any politicians in Australia lecturing the Chinese about their exchange rate policy, because our politicians are smart enough to know that that's not in Australia's interests.
I've got a question for both Michael and Saul to answer. Michael, would the Tasmanian economy be better off if you no longer had to spend time doing homework with your children? And would those benefits be offset, Saul, by the generationally, we'd have no one doing homework, and what would that do to productivity of the state?
Do you want to go first?
As a parent, I'm happy to. My personal, I've noticed the Minister of Education, and my view not dissimilar. I mean, the fact is that there is a balance here, if I take it seriously. I think that getting into good study habits early is a good idea, and setting time aside is a good idea. People can be have all the ability in the world, can be really good students at school, and they're not have the capacity to organise themselves. I think I speak for most parents when I identify with this. Organising children is not the easiest thing. And that I think that to encourage good organisation, discipline in terms of holding on to that time frame, there's plenty of time to play around and do all the things that I notice that the Parents and Friends Association want to encourage. But I think that it shouldn't be overdone, but again, as a parent, you've got to take responsibility for your child's activities, whatever they are. And that I think that is the key here. And not all children are the same. And that, but from my perspective, I like to see I wasn't a very good student, I have to say, and I wasn't very disciplined or very well organised as a child. But as a parent, I'm probably more aware of having those abilities. Over to you about the production.
Well, my daughter isn't coming home from pre-prep with homework yet either. Sometimes I'm tempted to think I should set her some for her if her teachers don't. But, I mean, in all seriousness, look, I know that David Bartlett, who I think in general talks a lot more sense about matters to do with education than education ministers have done for some time, has been quite scathing in his comments about the suggestion from the President of the Parents and Friends Association about these sorts of things, and I say hear, hear to what he says about that as he does about most other things. But one of the real issues, and I would have talked about it a bit if there'd been sufficient time for me to show the slides I was going to about Tasmania, is that one of the biggest problems that Tasmania faces over the medium term is the low level of educational attainment of the state's population. This state has by far the lowest proportion of people over the age of 25 with post-secondary qualifications and the highest proportion by far of people who fail to reach year 10. It has now, it didn't 3 years ago, but it again has the lowest retention rate to year 12 of year 10 students. And this is one of the main reasons why average incomes are lower in Tasmania than in other places. And as Robert alluded to in his question, while it's true and Tasmania is traditionally claimed as a source of comparative advantage that wages are lower in the state than anywhere else, when you scale that against the fact that productivity, output per hour, is lower than in any other state, and instead look at wages per dollar of goods and services produced, labour costs are actually higher in Tasmania than anywhere else except New South Wales and the ACT. So, you know, part of the longer term solution. And it's not just, I mean, obviously migration to the mainland has some impact on this. Obviously some people post-tertiary migration to the mainland does deprive Tasmania of more of its graduates than it does of most other states. I'm an example of that. But it starts sooner than that, with fewer kids going on to year 12 than in any other state. And, you know, anything that suggests that Tasmanian kids and Tasmanian households ought to be putting less into correcting that deficiency than they presently are, I think is doing Tasmania, Tasmanian kids and Tasmania's future an extraordinary disservice.
Thank you.